Dr. Hellboy sandwich?
No, I'm Dr. Meansies. I'm Dr. Heffersnaffer's overnight locum. Do you have any idea what time it is?
Oh, sorry. I'm in the States and it's afternoon here.
It's 2:59 in the morning. What are you doing calling from the United States? You right?
Well, I was attending HeroesCon in Charlotte, and that's a big comic book convention. It's got a lot of local creators and stuff. It's all awesome. But my flight, it was seriously delayed, and I'm not going to make it home in time for the next session now, my session with the doctor. I'm starting to have a panic attack over it. I feel like I'm going to be judged for failing to meet my obligations. I feel like someone's going to challenge my abilities and take everything away that defines me as a podcaster.
Wait. Crikey, this is not a session. This is an intercontinental phone call. You were diagnosed with DCOCD. You have wasted thousands of quid to travel to the land of tiki torches and QVC Hitler to ensconce yourself in the culture of your triggering psychological disorder. I cannot help someone so clearly in the grip of a mania. You should seek crisis care from a local physician. Give them a tingle, is Arvo. Uru, sir. Good night.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of DCOCD, in which two Americans will cover a very important arc from the 90s, Wonder Woman the Contest and Wonder Woman the Challenge of Artemis. This is a story from 1994, written by William Messner Loebs, with pencils by an upcomer at that point, Mike Diodato Jr. These books had covers by Brian Bolan, and the editor of this run was Paul Kupperberg. I approached Mike and Paul to review this arc because I felt it was as much an event as the Death of Superman and Reign of the Superman arc that they covered in an earlier episode, as well as that Batman Nightfall storyline that they covered. After all, this was the extreme 90s, and each member of the DC Trinity seemed destined to be replaced for a short period of time in their books. Alas, when I told Mike and Paul that they should cover this, they didn't think it met the threshold of an event. So I drugged their Fosters, you know, that's Australian for beer, and I decided to take over for the night. And who better to co-host this episode with me than Diana Fan Extraordinaire, Diablo Frank. So thanks for joining me, Frank, as we take over.
Well, again, you are the ones who stepped up and made sure that this happened. I was the lazy git who would have been perfectly happy to let them just kind of do their thing. But somebody needs to stand up for Wonder Woman. And given how many pod fadings have occurred since the Wonder Woman movie, there was a ton of Wonder Woman podcasts. We all sort of disappeared in the months that followed. I'm glad you were there to watch out for when I was not. And also, I'm a Texan, so hopefully I'm like the U.S. equivalent of an Aussie, but neither one of us is going to attempt a bad accent or mention Men at Work. So that's a shag thing.
Yes, I decided to lay off the Men at Work jokes and the shrimp on the Barbie. So we're just going to talk Wonder Woman, and hopefully this is going to go great.
And then afterwards, we'll record a one song each and talk about NXS. So it'll work out.
Yes. Perfect. Now, this run ran from Wonder Woman number 90 through Wonder Woman number 100, and then included a zero issue. And, of course, the 100 issue had a special holofoil enhanced double-length centennial issue. And for me, I think this put Wonder Woman sort of back in the comic book public consciousness. You know, we had kind of suffered through some periods on this book that weren't so great. This was a time when, you know, she worked in a fast food restaurant and maybe wasn't doing huge superheroics. And then all of a sudden with the really, I would say, dynamic art of Mike Diodato and, of course, Artemis replacing Wonder Woman, this kind of put her back into the spotlight. Do you agree?
Absolutely. The truth is, I've always cared for Wonder Woman. She's one of the great icons, the heroes that everybody gets introduced to superheroes through. And a child of the 70s, of course, I used to watch the Linda Carter TV show and the like. But like most people, I kind of took Wonder Woman for granted. And in the early 90s, you had all these big events going on. And of course, I showed up for the Death of Superman. I showed up for Nightfall. And I remember there was one of those Stanley soapbox knockoffs that DC was doing. I think Ruben Diaz was the one who was writing it. And he made this little inference that Wonder Woman is going to get her turn next. It was the Chromium Age, so I picked up on that hint. and decided, well, let me go ahead and start buying Wonder Woman based on this. Whatever notable fandom I represent in terms of Wonder Woman podcasting, blogging, and the like, it all comes back to that one article. If this event had not occurred, I might not have ever become a hardcore Wonder Woman fan. And I spent most of the latter half of the 90s with her being my absolute favorite hero. I still have tons of stuff that I buy. And, obviously, I continue to support her to this day. It all comes from this event, really.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, it's really crazy because I was not a Wonder Woman fan sort of growing up. And I picked up Wonder Woman number 88, which has a Brian Boland cover of Superman and Wonder Woman, because I'm a big Superman fan. And that cover was so crazy. And then I read it. And in that, she's fighting Artemis. And I was like, oh, this seems kind of interesting. And I'd never heard of this guy, Messner Loebs. Let me continue to collect. And so really, I started collecting Wonder Woman right before this arc happened and kind of really stumbled into it. And much like you, after this, I kind of have been looking for a great Wonder Woman run and have collected a bunch of small sort of runs of her stuff until this very day. You know, she's always somebody that I'm very interested in and hoping that we're going to get a good arc. And it all stemmed from this. So let's just get right into the event. And I'm going to do my best to try to encapsulate this. Basically, Diana starts out by going back to Paradise Island in the first issue. She has been away from Paradise Island. It's been missing. And she thinks it's only been gone for a couple of months. But because of the way magic time works, it's been missing for the Amazons for what feels like 10 years. And during that time, they have actually been brawling with the Bana Migdal, or Bana Migdal, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, which is sort of like a savage race of Amazons that had left Themyscira earlier on and then sort of came back to it. So there's this Amazon versus Amazon war, and then the two tribes of Amazon sort of team up because then they're battling werebeasts and monsters that Circe have sort of sent to attack the island. And now they're back on Earth. And when Diana arrives, Hippolyta is sort of like, hey, we've been gone for 10 years. The Earth is a great place of peace now because you've been our ambassador for so long. And Diana says, no, that's not really true. I've done my best, but I haven't made great inroads. And based upon that, Hippolyta says, we need to have another contest. We need to have another Wonder Woman take over that mantle and hopefully be a better ambassador for us. And in the subsequent contest, Artemis, one of the Bana Migdal Amazons, actually wins. She ends up going back to Man's World to represent Themyscira as Wonder Woman. And Diana feels she no longer belongs on Paradise Island, sports a new costume, and goes and becomes Diana. And both of them have sort of separate superheroic arcs in which they both end up interacting with, of all things, a mob war in Boston, in which one of the main actors is a supervillain named the White Magician. And then ultimately the two of them team up to defeat the White Magician, but in the end, shock, Artemis dies, and Wonder Woman ends up reclaiming her title. Do you think I hit on all the high points?
The vast majority, yes. A lot of people think that this was a really small thing because you didn't have something like Nightfall where you had a little number in the corner box to show where this story went into. But you're talking about pretty much literally a year worth of Wonder Woman comics. And so elements from the story arc found their way into an issue of Primal Force, three issues of Hawkman and Guy Gardner Warrior each, eight issues of Justice League of America, the crossover event Way of the Warrior that was covered by Luke Giaconetti and the late Sean Engel on the Just One of the Guys Green Lantern podcast, episodes 63 through 65, if you want to check those out. So you're looking at a grand total of almost 27 comic books, which is seemingly comparable to what you saw with the Superman and Batman arcs that everybody remembers. But I suppose because of the Wonder Woman arc, people forget how big this thing was for Wonder Woman fans and for DC's publishing slate.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think you have these images of Diana in kind of this like short black leather jacket and bike shorts, and you have this fiery redhead with what seems to be a mile long ponytail wearing the Wonder Woman outfit, and it's on posters and it's sort of plastered all over the place. And I'll tell you that I bought that Hawkman, those Hawkman issues because, hey, Diana was in that, and I want to see how the rest of the DCU is responding to her in this new role. So I do think that it sort of had ripples throughout the DC continuity. People had to react to this new Wonder Woman and this new role for Diana.
Yeah, and I had a similar experience. I had jumped on to Superman and Batman. I mostly stuck with their core titles, though, as part of the events. It didn't really serve as a gateway to other DC books for me because they dealt with it inside of their own titles. And because those events didn't energize me the way that this one did, so I started picking up Wonder Woman. I liked what I was getting, and so I tried Hawkman. I tried all these other books because Wonder Woman was in them, and it wasn't long before I started trying to buy every comic book that Wonder Woman appeared in. It very much had its intended effect on me, at least, to where I became more of a DC reader thanks to Diana's presence within the DC Universe in this time period.
You know, I'm sure we'll end up talking about sort of the bootylicious artwork of Mike Diodato at some point. But, you know, other parts of the story that I really like was that there was a lot of flashback stuff to Paradise Island. We learned a lot about Heracles and Hippolyta getting together and Heracles taking over and how, you know, Diana ended up winning the original contest. So for me, you know, I kind of knew the one-page origin of Wonder Woman that we, you and I, that is, reviewed in sort of the Secret Origins Digest, right? I kind of knew that. So this actually helped build on some of that history. And then later on, as you go through the story, you know, there are some, you know, secrets that Hippolyta has been hiding through this that kind of built up a little bit of intrigue. And then there's this whole, hey, it's us versus them, these, you know, more primitive Amazons that are living outside the walls and how they don't feel like they're respected. So there was a lot of stuff going on here that I think sort of really helped build up her mythos in this sort of new, you know, 1990s DCU. So it wasn't just, hey, I got replaced for 10 issues. It was, Hippolyta's been lying to me for a long period of time. You know, I look just like her sister, who was the head of this other tribe. So I do think it helped kind of flesh things out.
Yeah, there is a sense of viewing the Amazons a homogeneous society, that they're all the same. They all have the same beliefs, the same inclinations. And one of the things that was interesting about the story arc and some stuff that George Perez had done that set this up was that the Bounty McDall was sort of like the lost tribe of the Amazons. When the choice was made to either go to Paradise Island and live in peace or to take the war back to mankind after Heracles had assaulted the Amazons, Hippolyta's sister Antiope chose to take the battle to him. It ended up costing her life, but that's the birthplace of the Bounty McDall. Is these were the more feudal Amazons. They continued to live in man's world for centuries, so they're actually more adept in man's world than the Amazons themselves. They used modern weaponry, they had more modern technology, and suddenly they're being fused back into the original Amazon culture. There was a lot of tension from that. And so it kind of showed that there was more to the Amazons than just women in togas dancing on the beach and the like. Wonder Woman had gotten so involved in the culture of George Perez's take on the character and the mythology and a very kind of isolated continuity. You didn't feel like you belonged unless you were in the Wonder Woman Club and in the George Perez Club. And I think that this arc opened up the Wonder Woman comic books to the general public in a greater way. And I think in particular, the art of Mike Diodato Jr. let people know that, hey, Wonder Woman is kind of cool. Wonder Woman isn't just this pristine figure that nothing ever happens to. She got to take part in the 90s through this story, and she invited a lot of people that wouldn't necessarily have read Wonder Woman comics or even DC comics through this arc.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, and we're going to touch on the art a lot through this, but Diodato's art, I think, was kind of like what brought people in, right? I mean, he really had sort of this massively stylized look about him that, yes, there were thongs and there were bras and there's all that sort of stuff, but it really is beautiful art. You know, you have to take that cheesecake part of it with the rest of it. But then when you read it, it's like somehow amidst all of this cheesecake is Artemis fighting a villain named the Chauvinist, and Artemis fighting a villain named the Exploiter, who's like having women work in sweatshops, and even Diana in her role as like private detective stopping a stalker and trying to emphasize feminist ideals. So it's kind of an interesting read in that, yeah, there's a lot of cheekiness to this, if you know what I'm saying, but you're being exposed to what that Amazonian ideal is and what they're trying to bring to man's world just from two different approaches, a very proactive approach with Artemis, who's going out and attacking, and then Diana trying to be more of an ambassador.
Yeah, and also, William Esther Loebs is very much a humanist. He had a very sweet take on Wonder Woman, very down-to-earth, telling stories that would not necessarily make it in most mainstream comic books. And I love those stories, but they weren't necessarily commercial and they weren't cool and happening in that time period. So you have Diodato coming in, bringing that very imagey style, something that you weren't really seeing in most DC books. Very few of the DC titles had that kind of flash to them that could attract the image audience, the Marvel audience. And so you ended up with this conflict between Master Loeb's inclinations and Deodato's inclinations, and I think that tug of war enhanced the books. They basically got to have their cheesecake and eat it too.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's exactly right. So, you know, I think to move along, because I know that, you know, these are supposed to be sort of flybys, look at these events. From what changed from this series and what was launched? You know, I think we got Artemis out of this. We got a really good look at the Bonne McDowell. We got that biker costume that I still see now and then. We got a new look at Cersei. From a comic viewpoint, we saw Deodato, who really is a force then and now. I reached out to Paul Kupperberg, and I just asked him, like, what were his recollections about this? And he was actually nice enough to get back to me. And so what he said is, you know, I don't remember exactly how the replacement story came up. All I remember is that I wanted to get into a storyline that was as far from the previous, quote, working in a taco stand, quote, arc as possible. I'm sure we were influenced by the other major characters having their shake-up storylines, but really the big idea was to give Diana back some dignity. I was surprised that Deodato wasn't already a star because his samples were amazing. And yes, from right up front, Artemis was always meant to die, but when the run turned out to be successful, someone in marketing told me sales on Wonder Woman went up 50% on the Loeb's Deodato run. We brought her back in her miniseries. I didn't know the run would be as successful as it turned out to be, but I thought, if nothing else, the readers would come for the Mike Deodato art and stay for the Bill Loeb story. So I think that kind of fits nicely into what you were saying, that it was going to be the art that was going to get people to pick the book up, but it was really going to be Loeb's story that was going to keep them coming back.
Yeah, and in truth, Kupperberg actually lowballs the numbers. I was looking at Comicron to get a sense of where the book was before Deodato versus where it ended up. And back in the day, Diamond Comic Distributors used an index where it was the percentage of copies of Batman sold when Batman was the standard bearer for comic sales. At the early part of Deodato's run, Wonder Woman was selling about 30% of what the main Batman title was selling. By the end of the run, it was selling 90% of what Batman was selling, and this is at a time where Batman sales had gone through the roof. The book started out outside the top 100, and by the time John Byrne came on, it was in the top 20. So an enormous difference in terms of sales and, by extension, impact on readership.
I didn't realize the numbers were that crazy. I knew that it was more popular, but that's just insane. I mean, you know, when was the last time that Wonder Woman was that prevalent in sales? I mean, I don't know.
Certainly the earliest days of George Perez drawing the book, and not for many years since then.
Yeah. All right. So I guess the first thing we need to do is to define what type of event this is. Is it an occupier? Is it a launcher? Is it a fixer? Or is it a vanity project? So for me, I think that this is more of a launcher than anything else, right? You heard from Kupperberg's response. He was really trying to break from the past and sort of try to get a new sort of vision involved. And nothing works better than sort of like having somebody else take the mantle for a while and then having Diana come back. And I think because of this, you had all of these new ideas around the history of Paradise Island, the history of the Amazons, and really what Diana was attempting to do in Man's World. So I think it's a launcher. What do you think?
I actually disagree. I think it was a fixer. I think that there was a sense of what the Wonder Woman book was going to be. When George Perez left in a huff after War of the Gods, he had been on the book for about 5 years, and he had this basically a cult of personality where the people who'd come on when he took over Wonder Woman had decided that what he was doing was the end-all be-all of Wonder Woman, and anybody who got too far away from what Perez was doing it wrong. And to some degree, William Messner Loeb was Perez's handpicked successor. I think that he was the suggested writer to take over from him and definitely carried on a lot of Perez's concerns, keeping the scale smaller, more personal, continuing to work with his supporting cast, although probably not to the degree that the Perez fans would have liked. And so Messner Loeb's really kind of stayed the course. And the problem with that is the book had declined significantly in sales after Perez had stopped drawing the title. It had been isolated from the main DC universe for so long. Perez didn't see it as a superhero book. He really was dealing more in modern mythology. And so Diana had become very disconnected from the greater DC universe, much to her detriment in terms of getting eyes on the book itself. And because Messner Loeb was continuing that course, the sales just weren't coming up. There were some attempts to get sales up. They tried to push Lee Motor when he came on the book, for instance, who is an artist I love. I thought he did great work on the book, but he wasn't going to catch fire in the way that they needed him to. So when Kupperberg started pushing the book back into superhero stories, got the flashy artist to work on the book, started telling more stories in line with what other DC titles were doing to grab attention, because so much of the attention had gone to Marvel and Image in that time period. DC had dropped to being third place as a publisher because of the impact of Image. So there was a desperation to do something to get people to actually pay attention to the classic iconic heroes. I think that's what they did. there was some attempts at launching. You did get like the Artemis miniseries, and you did get some specials and stuff a little further down the line once John Byrne came on, but really didn't see a lot of stuff spin off from this. It didn't really explode Wonder Woman in terms of having a family of titles or anything like you saw with the other books, but it did fix a problem with the character. It got sales going. It gave her some momentum that she desperately needed. So personally, I would see it as a fixer.
All right. So, knowing that that's what we think, I'll tell you that from an eventiness scale, I'm giving this a score of 8. I put this in sort of the same category as those Batman and Superman stories in terms of somebody comes on and takes on the mantle. It's up to our hero to reclaim it. I think it launched sort of a new direction in this book, and I think it just sort of put her back in the public eye.
I'm grading on a curve. As people who've ever listened to my stuff know, I'm a pretty severe individual. And so I might have gone with a different numbering system, but we're directly comparing this to what happened with Superman and Batman. And so on the curve, I'm giving it a 7. I recognize that obviously nothing is going to have similar impact to what the Death of Superman had. Arguably, it changed comics going forward. The falling of Batman also was a huge deal. I mean, they adapted it into a major motion picture a few years ago. So I can't underestimate what impact that had. I know that in terms of greater sales, it probably wasn't anywhere near close to those, but in terms of the impact the story had for Wonder Woman and building her into a character that got adapted into her own multi-million dollar motion picture, I do think that this is a key moment in her history. I do think that it brought a lot of new fans to her and a lot of attention to her and basically forced DC to start treating her as though she were part of a trinity of heroes, where before she was just one of their spare heroines, it seemed like, or a book they published to, you know, hold on to rights, depending on what you've heard from. I, back in the DC message board days, I reached out to William Messner Loebs and asked him about DC's ownership status with regard to Wonder Woman, and his understanding was that they did have to publish the book because of an agreement they had with the William Moulton Marston estate. So, to some degree, the book was an obligation more than an ongoing concern. And I think starting with the story arc, it became a concern for DC to make sure that Wonder Woman was held up to the same stature as Superman and Batman. So, at a minimum of 7 for me. In terms of the writing, again, listening to the other podcasts that have been done for Superman and Batman, I think that some of the writing and the art and the eventiness all over, they kind of gave them high ranks. And I'm not comfortable with underselling Wonder Woman. But one other thing they also did is sprawl. I didn't realize it at the time, but when they covered the Doomsday event, they weren't just talking about the fight between Doomsday and Superman. They were talking about Funeral for a Friend, Reign of the Supermen, the whole sprawl of the event. Same goes for Nightfall, Night Quest, Night's End. And so really, if you're going to be honest about the story arc, while it technically takes place over these 12 issues involving Artemis and the biker outfit and everything, it's actually the summation of William Messner Loebs' entire run. One of the first major story arcs he had was the introduction of the new villain, the White Magician. The resolution of that storyline is also the resolution of this story. So really, it encompasses the entire William Messner Loebs' run because there's so many elements that make more sense and will be more rewarding if you were following from the very beginning. If you factor in the sprawl, I would give it a very high writing credit, but I think that that might be a little too much of an overreach. I'm still going to give it an 8 because I think that if you read both on its own and the greater William Messner Loeb's arc, it's a better story than Doomsday or Nightfall. And looking at the scores that event got, I wouldn't feel comfortable giving it less than an 8.
All right. I graded it a little bit harder than you. I gave it a 6. And part of it is that I feel that the end part of this, which is two Boston mobs, one being led by the widow of the mobster and the other the mobster being forced out of power, and how the White Magician ends up working with one mob and the other, just seems a little bit too down to earth when I think about all of the fantastical stuff that's happening around it. And so I think just because there's so much guys with guns and the mob wife, you know, lounging at the pool trying to convince people that she's in charge, that just kind of had to take a step back to me. The Paradise Island stuff, the Diana Artemis stuff, even Diana on her own sort of trying to figure out what she's going to be without that mantle of Wonder Woman, all that stuff I think is great. It's just that side plot that becomes bigger and bigger as this moves on that just kind of made it detract more. All of that said, I mean it when I say I love this run. So, you know, maybe that's a little bit harsh, but that's the number I'm going to stick with.
Yeah, if you're trying to take a story on its own, that would probably feel very extraneous. It goes back to my argument where it's of a piece with everything else that William Esther Lowes was doing. That was a story arc that had begun in earlier issues so that I'm sure he felt the need to resolve. But it's sort of like the, what was it, the Underworlders that were in the Superman story, where to me as a new reader of Superman, that meant nothing to me. So I completely understand your point of view on that.
All right. Moving on to art and covers. This has Brian Boland covers, and those covers alone, and he had done covers for this title much before this arc, but those covers alone probably make this a winner from an art point of view. I mean, as I said, I bought Wonder Woman number 88 just because of the Boland cover, and I stuck around to read through this. Those are some iconic, symbolic, really spectacular covers, but there's no denying the impact of Mike Diodato here. You can debate the content. Everything became more extreme, more sexy, skimpier. The thongs became wedgier. The breasts became more globular. But I don't think you can deny his talent. And when he does a lot of facial close-ups, he really draws beautiful characters. Plus, this was like the extreme 90s. You know, the men are just mountains of muscle. There are panels that are jagged with rough edges. There are, you know, panels that are shattered like glass. This really is a style that just explodes off the page. And this put Diodato on the map, and as a result, it put Wonder Woman on the map. So I'm going to give the art for this a 9.
And I'm going to concur. I'm also going to give it a 9. Again, you have to make Chromium Age allowances. There are so many butts in this thing. The abs are impossible. No human being could have these abs. They're really Barbie dolls, in all honesty. But these were Chromium Age comic books. To some degree, you could argue that the bad girl fad that came in the mid-90s, one of the last big speculator situations after the general bust of the industry, to a large degree started with Wonder Woman. The arc that introduced the new Circe, the two-part story arc, that was before Mike Diodato came in, but the first appearance of this new Circe became one of the hot wizard books and really brought new readers in because they thought that this was going to be a major character. And then once they got a shot of Mike Diodato Jr., the sales went crazy. People thought so much more of the character. And after so many years of this very staid, stiff artwork, those jagged panels, and nothing was symmetrical. Everything was just blasting at you. It was so exciting. And today you look back on it and you might turn your nose at it, but at the time, it energized you to read the stuff. And looking at it today, there are tons of stories from that time period that I just don't care to read anymore, whether they're too long or the art's just not there. And this is one of those few books where it's an event from DC in the mid-90s, and I would be totally down to read this again because, in part, the art is just so exciting, and they're having so much fun. And yeah, you might feel a little un-PC looking at this stuff, but it's fantastic. Again, you have the ball in covers. But also, I have to point out, this is a 12-issue arc. You know who drew the entire 12-issue arc? Mike Diodato Jr. I listen to people talk about the Doomsday story arc, and this guy likes Tom Grumman, and this guy likes John Bogdanov, or to be honest, this guy who's talking likes John Bogdanov, apparently, because nobody else did. You have such a wide variety of art styles, and just there's not something for everybody. The same thing happened with Nightfall. I really, as much as I love Jim Aparo, his work toward the end of his career was just heartbreaking because he had fallen so far. He was slowly going blind. It wasn't his fault, but he just could not produce the level of work that he once had. Mike Manley, who I thought became a much better artist over the years, I was not happy with his work at that time period, and there were just so many different artists coming in and out at different times. But you look at this story arc, 12 issues. If you like Diodato at the beginning, you're going to like it at the end because it's going to look the same. It's going to have that same level of excitement. You're going to have that consistency, the same writer too. This is a more complete novel, if you will, than pretty much any of the other major DC events for that time period, because the same guys did all 12 issues. It was an accomplishment then, and it's an even bigger accomplishment now to keep the same people on 12 consecutive issues to tell one complete story. And for art this dynamic that makes you want to read the comic so much, how can you not give it high praise?
I completely agree. All right, and the last category is impact and legacy. You want to go first?
Sure. This is another instance where, coming into DCOCD, I have a tendency to take a big picture view. What is the size of the event? Does it take place over the entire universe? How many hundreds of characters get involved? But based on what we saw in the Nightfall and Doomsday episodes, it's also the impact on the individual character, the impact on the icon, the impact in sales. And if you look at this story, This was the definitive end of the Perez era. This was the turning point where Wonder Woman finally rejoined the DC Universe. And so you really put a capstone on the beginning of the post-crisis era for that character. You had the new version of Cersei that became a popular character who's appeared in cartoons, who it will probably turn up in one of the movies in the near future. And a lot of her, the attention that was directed at that character, the fact that she became the premier Wonder Woman villain for his time period there, that started around this time period, during this run. You had the new costumes. You had the boost in sales. You had the fact that really before this period, Wonder Woman wasn't seen as part of a trinity. Nobody said the DC Trinity before this and the Matt Wagner miniseries that used that term. And now everybody thinks of DC as Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, which really wasn't the case in the 90s and for some time prior to that. This was the first Wonder Woman story arc to get trade paperbacks since probably like the 70s, you know, hardcovers that came out that collected Golden Age stories. She did not get trades before this point. This is what got that started. And it would actually be a number of years later they put out like one John Byrne trade, and it was years later before they came back to that. So it shows how many people wanted to read this book that they saw it as viable trade material. It launched the Bad Girl craze. It launched Mike Deodato Jr., who's become one of the defining artists of Marvel Comics. It's a shame they couldn't keep him at DC, but he's been like their guy for 20-some-odd years now, one of their main people. He's like their John Buscema. It set the stage for John Byrne returning to DC Comics and taking over the book because the sales had gotten to a point where DC actively looked for name-brand talent to continue the trajectory started by this creative team. You had the Artemis Requiem miniseries, an actual miniseries launching out of Wonder Woman book that pretty much never was happening before that. And that launched the career of Ed Bennis, another major artist that, while personally not to my taste, was a major force at DC Comics, especially in the aughts. Artemis went on to appear in Secret Six. She's a regular character in Red Hood and the Outlaws. She became a mentor to the Cassie Sandsmark Wonder Girl. She's been adapted to animation. Rosario Dawson did her voice, for God's sake. She's been in toys. She's been in dolls. She's pretty much the only actual Amazon versus a Donna Troy or a Cassie Sandsmark that the average reader could name. If you're trying to figure out, well, who's an Amazon? Wonder Woman, maybe Hippolyta, and then Artemis. This had a huge impact on the character and on the legacy of Wonder Woman in general. So I think that's extremely important. And that's why I ended up giving it a ranking of 8. The only thing that brought it down was the fact that it did not have the kind of enormous sales impact that the Superman and Batman events did. It's not as well remembered. Again, it was going to be looked over by our guys at DCOCD until Ange stepped up and made sure that this happened. But relative to the character, an 8.
Yeah, I think that you covered all of the major things that grew out of this. I'm also giving it an 8. One of the things that I'll say is that I think that while this might not be well remembered from people that are looking back at the DC Universe as a whole, this is an arc that Wonder Woman fans still talk about, right? They talk about that Mike Deodato run with Messner Loebs where, like, all of a sudden, you know, Wonder Woman was a hot topic. And, you know, they talk about that Artemis miniseries coming out of it, that she was brought back because she was so popular in this, that she was supposed to be a throwaway character that suddenly people realized that she was better than they anticipated. And from that point of view, I mean, if we're still talking about this arc 30 years after it came out, that alone has to sort of count for a great impact. People don't talk about the Jodi Picoult era, right? People don't talk about the Andrew Kreisberg era. They still talk about the Messner Loebs era, and they still talk about this as sort of the launching point for Mike Deodato. So I think it deserves an 8 as well. And that's why I sort of fought for it, because I think, again, in my mind, you know, you have Superman being replaced, you have Batman being replaced, you have Wonder Woman being replaced. There was that time period that DC did that to their big characters, and she belonged as one of them.
And what's funny is she really pioneered that. Having Superman be replaced, you might have that for like a story, usually an imaginary story besides. Batman was pretty much always going to be Bruce Wayne, but there's a long history of Wonder Woman getting replaced by other Amazons, other contenders. The fact is it's built into her origin that she had to fight for this role in a contest with other potentially worthy Amazons. And so once they did the story, I think that some people may have seen it as Johnny Come Lately, but to me it was Wonder Woman reclaiming her own narrative that had been borrowed by the other two heroes. And also, when you read the story arc, there's elements of it we haven't touched on. There's twists in this thing. There's more to it than meets the eye. It's not just that story, but you're going to have to read it for yourself to find out what those twists happen to be.
All right, so those are our scores, and I'll recap them in a second, but we do have to get our semi-OCD, and for that, I contacted our good friend Martin Gray. And I got to tell you, Martin had a lot to say about this as well. He easily could have replaced me and talked to you about this, and so I'm just going to have to touch on some of his comments. I'm looking at the time. And I want to make sure that we're doing this in a timely fashion. So from an eventiness point of view, Mark gave it a 5 out of 10. He says, You know, Diana being replaced should have felt like a big deal, but after Superman and Batman's similar journeys, how could it seem like anything other than a stunt? You know, the contest ends with a redheaded, impulsive Amazon named Artemis usurping Diana's role as Themyscira's ambassador. Longtime readers would find this very familiar when Orana did it all in the first Wonder Woman volume in numbers 250 to 251. Like Azrael, Artemis was so basically unsuited for the role, you knew that she would be unseated, just like Dick Grayson can be Batman's only successor, Donna Troy can only be Diana's. As a result, while it was meant to be a big deal for the Wonder Woman book, it never felt like an event affecting the wider DC universe. So again, 5 out of 10. From writing, he says Bill Loeb is one of the best writers Wonder Woman ever had, but sadly this Artemis story overshadows his really great work earlier on in the book, such as the Space Pirate story. It reads like an editorially driven event rather than the quirky, wonderful human stories that preceded it. The Challenge of Artemis is part of a run that did see Loeb's return to form somewhat. Diana got her sense of humor, and to hear Poison Ivy inject some black humor into this was very good. He loved that Diana used some obscure powers to sort of battle Pan, but by the time Artemis's tenure in the Star-Spangled costume ends, Loeb is back to form. As a result, he gives writing 8 out of 10. From art and covers, he talks about Brian Boland's covers and how he always liked the new costume that Boland designed and the straight hair that Diana had. He did like that Diodato, as we've said, really had a dynamism in his action sequences, movements between panels with thick, scratchy borders and such things as palpable impact of blows between Artemis and her massive male maniacs. That he brings up a particular two-page spread in which Wonder Woman punches Artemis through a building through panels that together spell a sound effect. So he says, while the art isn't particularly for his taste, it's perfect for the storyline of this period, 8 out of 10. And then from an impact and legacy point of view, we said, you know, this gave us Artemis as an ongoing anti-hero who is still around today. But Diana never really followed up on much when it came to Artemis. She never thought about Artemis once John Byrne took over. In terms of the real world, though, the run's biggest legacy was Diodato's lunatic art, which spawned a mini house style with the likes of Ed Bennis apparently asked to imitate his post-image stylings. So he gives it an impact of 6 out of 10. So in reviewing all of these scores, you in total gave it a score of 32. I in total gave it a score of 31. And then Mart gave it a total score of 27, which divided in half because he's semi-OCD is a score of 14. And as a result, this arc and this event has a total score of 77. So we'll hand that over to Paul and Mike to put on their list to sort of see where this falls. But I can tell you that both Doomsday and Nightfall both scored 82. So this is just a touch below that, probably appropriately.
I won't argue with that. And I think that it probably fared a good bit more than most people would have thought, especially if they didn't read the book at that time period. I absolutely agree with a lot of what Martin had to say, but compared to a lot of the other events that were coming around that time period, I do think that Wonder Woman stands head and shoulders above.
I can't thank you enough for covering this because, you know, I have these trades. I have these books. I bought them off the rack. This is probably one of the Wonder Woman arcs that I will go back and reread for all of the reasons that you said. And that alone makes it feel like an event.
And I just wish that we could get a nice big omnibus or at least some trades from those earlier William Esther Loeb's issues. As Martin said, the Space Pirates arc is fantastic. There's a ton of great material in there. I'm a big fan of the Ares Buchanan arc, which is what really made me a Wonder Woman fan. There's so much material that needs to be collected that's so much better than a lot of the newer stuff that has been collected. And I think that you could ignite an impassion in new Wonder Woman fans if they had that kind of quality material out there.
All right. Well, I'll thank Paul and Mike for letting us talk about this. I know that we've probably gone a little bit longer than the usual episodes, but clearly there's a lot of love for Wonder Woman between Frank and I. And so thanks again, guys, for letting us cover this.
Beautiful as Aphrodite. Wise as Athena. Stronger than Hercules. Swifter than Mercury. Explore the 75-year history of the Amazon Princess with Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace, a monthly podcast available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wonderwomanwarriorforpeace.wordpress.com.
Now first, there are things that you must know about me. I have two different identities.
You're not just Wonder Woman?
No, I'm also Diana Prince, United States Navy. It's a very necessary part of my plan. It allows me to be military intelligence, where I can know immediately where I'm most needed.
The Diana Prince Wonder Woman podcast, available on iTunes, Shout Engine, and the Internet Archive.
Oh, okay. Call number. Waiting. Hello?
Dr. Andrew's office. This is Frank speaking.
Oh, hi. I'm trying to reach someone about an urgent episode of DCOCD.
I'm sorry. Dr. Ange isn't that kind of doctor, but I'm part of a group of recovering DCOCD sufferers. Perhaps I can help you walk through it, talk you through it.
Well, I'm desperate right now. I'll take any help you can give me. What issues of DCOCD are you working through?
Well, with me, like most people, it all started with crisis. From there, I got a bad case of Titan's Hunt, but the problem didn't really get going until Bloodlines.